I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty, so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
The Collier Brothers.
Who were the Collier Brothers? They were a pair of affluent and educated siblings whose lives took a strange turn as they retreated into isolation amidst the changing cultural landscape of the post-Great Depression Harlem. The brothers spent nearly two decades hoarding and booby-trapping their inherited four-story mansion until their eventual deaths in the late 1940s.
Act 1, Promising Futures. For most of us, change implies an inherent level of stress. Change is hard. Change is often daunting, scary, and overwhelming. In most cases, no one would blame you for having trouble adapting to a major change in your life. Yet, we also typically agree that change is healthy and hold a certain level of fear for our lives growing stagnant. The world will always continue to move forward, and few among us actively wish to be left behind. As such, we often find ourselves in a seemingly endless state of contradiction, forever seeking the equilibrium between change and consistency, which keeps us content. At times, however, the conditions in which we find ourselves settling into may not align with what society deems acceptable or with what any rational individual would perceive as conducive to health and well-being. Homer Lusk Collier, born November 6, 1881, and Langley Wakeman Collier, born October 3, 1885, were the only surviving children of Herman Livingston Collier and his first cousin, Susie Gage Frost Collier, which is like a sentence.
Yeah. It really is.
The couple had lost their firstborn, a daughter named Susan, at 4 months old due to undocumented reasons. The family lived in a simple apartment for the majority of the brothers' childhoods. During this time, the two boys attended public school while Herman interned at the Bellevue Hospital and Susie sang opera at the 14th Street Academy of Music. Both Homer and Langley later attended Columbia University. Homer obtained a degree in law while Langley studied engineering and chemistry, though he ultimately strayed from this path for a fairly successful stint as a concert pianist. It is safe to say that the entire Collier family, with their academic achievements, promising careers, and artistic talents, boasted a promising future with far brighter prospects than those available to the majority of individuals living around the turn of the century. By 1909, the brothers were well into their 20s, and their father, now an established gynecologist, purchased the infamous four-story Harlem brownstone at 2078 Fifth Avenue, and the whole family moved in. At the time, Harlem was an affluent and fashionable neighborhood.
Can we just talk for a second about how this dude just straight up married his cousin? We can't just like blow by that, right? Like we're going to talk about it, right?
He married his first cousin. It wasn't even like a third cousin or something like that. He just married his cousin and they were just like, we're having three kids, baby.
So here's my question. Like today, marrying your first cousin would be not so good. People would look at you weird. It would be strange. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, was still the case, right? Like, it was still not chill to, like, marry your cousins, right?
I think there was definitely certain times where marrying your cousin, the further back you go, was, like, a lot more socially acceptable. I think that certainly, like, firmly, you know, prior to this, the 15, 16, 1700s, like, marrying your cousin was not considered strange. I do think that in certain areas, marrying your cousin is less frowned upon simply because, like, you live in a small town and there's just not a lot of people around. And sometimes that's just in the spirit of like, oh, I need to like further my bloodline and, you know, have a family and have children, which everybody is supposed to do under that belief system. Some people marry their cousins because there's not a whole lot of options around them. Whether like at this time marrying your cousin had started to become taboo, I'm not 100% sure. I think maybe the lines are a little blurry. I think definitely like in the 1900s and beyond, it started to become a lot more like not a thing, you know. But then again, like in the 1950s, Jerry Lee Lewis married his 15-year-old cousin, which was the double whammy of cousin who was also an underage girl. So I don't know. They weren't operating off a full deck of cards back then, I don't think.
That's brutal, dude. I'm not into that. The other question I have is, Is it abnormal for a man to be a gynecologist at this point in time? No, right? Because most doctors are men because of entrenched misogyny?
I think it was mostly men. And also the act medicine and science around like gynecology and women's health was really weird and fucked up at this time, where they just thought like if women were like having medical problems, they just needed to like have an orgasm and they would be fine. It was a lot of fucked up weird shit. But yes, mostly men. Is that like they're not wrong? Is that the shrug you're doing?
I didn't say anything. What are you talking about? I'm listening to you.
But yeah, I think most doctors entirely were men. And then, like, nurses and midwives were women. Not a good thing.
Can we also talk about the fact that they just have, like, the most baller middle names ever? Lusk and Wakeman? Like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. Homer Lusk Collier and Langley Wakeman Collier.
Like, these dudes, like, they have great names. Like, these sound like a name that I would put in something, and you would be like,
yeah,
I don't know, man. Those names are too extreme. And I'm like, no! Langley Wakeman Collier! And then you'd be like,
They're great names. I mean, what was their dad? I'm trying to remember what their dad's name was.
Herman Livingston Collier.
Yeah. I mean, Herman Livingston Collier, that's pretty good. It's not as good as their names. But even their mom, who obviously is from a different family, she's got a pretty good name. Susie Gage Frost Collier. That's a pretty good name.
That's a pretty good name.
It's a name that has a verb, a subject, a predicate, a verb, and an adverb.
If you told me that these names were from an Earl MacRouch novel, I would believe you. I'd be like, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, they're good names. And also, so their dad, Herman, he was considered to be a bit of an eccentric of the time. So they lived in New York City, and he was a doctor, a gynecologist, as we just discussed, and he would canoe to work on the East River.
I kind of love that, though. Like, this dude's out here living life on his own terms. If he fucks who he wants to fuck. He boats where he wants to boat. He names his children what he wants to name his children. And it won't stop him getting to work. If there's a river in the way, laws about not having procreation with your blood relatives, or, this binary of just a first and a last name. No, there's going to be three, maybe sometimes four names to everybody who is in his social circle.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, just keep naming until you get tired.
Yeah, yeah.
The first middle last name paradigm is like a triangulation, right? You're identifying your family line with the surname. You're creating a name that people call you by so that when you're in casual social interactions, there's some kind of label that you can be referred to. And then the middle name is the specific demarcation of like, I am this specific individual for legal and like paperwork purposes. But why stop there? Just keep naming until you decide that there's enough names.
I wish I had nine names. I'm just going to go out there on a limb and say that.
Dave, Michael, a more sophisticated weapon for more modern times. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on. Get paid, Baker.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking more along the lines of Dave, I don't want to marry my cousin's Baker. But yes, what you said is better.
Yeah, because then, like, that's a slippery slope. Because eventually, you name yourself that, and then eventually, one day, you're starting to think about it, and you're like, maybe I do want to marry my cousins. Like, it's like reverse psychology.
You know what they say? Methinks thy protest too much.
Yeah, and how much can you protest more than naming yourself, I don't want to marry my cousin?
That's what I'm saying, man.
That's a lot of protesting.
It's not even like an experiment that would be cheap to get out of. It's not like I don't want to have sex with my cousin, which is something you can experiment with and then be like, this wasn't for me. I don't want to marry my cousin, which is a legally binding document, which means I have to get married in order to figure out that I don't want to do that.
I mean, you could do one of those like Vegas marriages that aren't like real. I'm just coming up with solutions here. I'm not playing games. Not much is known about the family during this time period, though it seems reasonable to assume they enjoyed a thoroughly upper-class degree of stability. However, a full decade later, in 1919, a significant disruption occurred in their lives when Herman and Susie divorced for undisclosed reasons. Following the divorce, Herman relocated to a residence in Upper West Side, leaving the Harlem mansion to his wife and children. Tragically, Herman passed away just a few years later in 1923. The subsequent owner of Herman's house allegedly found the basement brimming with an assortment of furniture and possessions, even including a complete Model T Ford. See, you know, you trash talk marrying your cousin, but just based on the data we have right here available to us, if you aren't married to your cousin, you die.
That's true. I've heard that from multiple sources, actually.
It's like a reverse the ring. It's not like, oh, if you watch this video, then 7 days later you die. If you aren't married to your cousin, 2 years later you die.
Which is one of those things that seems like it's really easy to get out of, but it's actually, there's a lot of people dying because of it.
Yeah, because it's honestly difficult to be married to your cousin, because it's like you're going to the same family functions.
That raw sexual chemistry, man.
Yeah, it's hard. It's tough. It's tough out there for cuz pulls.
This bit has gone way out of control.
I can see it working in Dave's mind. Like he's like, what cousins do I have, actually? He's like going through his phone contacts. Honestly, I mean, all joking aside, it's pretty wild. Like,
don't say you dreamt about fucking your cousin. Don't do it. Don't do it.
No, I definitely did. What I was going to say is the opposite. I was going to say, like, I guess in certain situations where you just aren't close with your cousins, but like, I guess because I grew up where I was very close with my cousins, I can't even imagine thinking that way. Like, in my mind, like my cousins are very similar to my brothers and sisters in terms of like how I thought of them as family. So I can't even imagine like thinking that way about cousins.
You ready for me to blow your mind? Do you remember that one time that you were working at, I think it was like a Burger King or something, and you were taking trash out back and a young woman drove by in a car and said you're cute?
That was you and you're my cousin?
No, but that woman was your cousin.
Oh shit. I mean, I'll still take it.
Yeah, you will.
But I don't know how I feel about it now. Prompted by this discovery, the brothers reclaimed their father's belongings and transported the entirety of the basement's content back to the Harlem brownstone. The brothers even took apart the Model T to store it within the walls of their home. This event is often speculated upon as being possibly an initial cause of their attachment to the material possessions and later hoarding tendencies. Though despite this possibility, from what is known about the family beyond the confines of their home, all appear to be well for nearly another decade. And this is like a really interesting thing to talk about, and this is going to become a lot more relevant as the episode goes on, and you'll start to see why. But just right up front, it's really weird and fascinating that it's like their father had a Model T Ford in his basement. So like, number one, how did he get it in there? How the fuck did he get a Model T Ford into his basement? And number two, why? Why did he have a Model T Ford in his basement? Like, I can't even imagine what the reason for that is. Because obviously, there's a couple of things. So this is the late 1800s. So cars are like a new thing. It's not like nowadays where you might have some beat up, broken down old Pontiac that's hanging out in your garage that you just, it broke down one day and you just never got it fixed and you just haven't done anything about it and you just haven't sold it or taken it to a junkyard or whatever. But like, cars are new. Having a car is like a luxury, and any car that you can buy at this time is like, was built within the last couple of years. Why does he have it in the basement of his house? And then on top of that, whenever he dies and then they get all of his stuff out of it, the Collier brothers, they're not like, oh shit, our dad had a Model T Ford, I guess we got a new ride, baby, and start driving around the city. They break it down and put it into the walls of their house. What does that mean? Why?
It's a metaphor.
Why
it's
did a they metaphor. Do that?
I have no
so,
idea.
So we're going to get it. I mean, as we've kind of alluded to here a couple times, you know, we're getting into some extreme hoarding type territory. And this is the early signs of it. But it's just like, it really just it illuminates to me and honestly, I've been accused mostly by my wife of being a hoarder of because I like to keep things. And I'm in that mindset of like, I have like a piece of wood or like a random plastic piece from something. And I'm thinking in my head, like, one day this is going to come in handy and I'm going to be able to use this and make it into something. And so I'll hold on to random junk for decades or whatever. But even though I'm that type of person, like, it really illuminates the difference, the pure just cognitive difference between my brain and somebody who's just obsessed with collecting and holding on to things for the sake of it. Because it's like, I don't even understand the thought process behind why you would take a car and put it in the walls of your house. I don't even know what the fuck that means.
Mental illness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, some kind of hereditary mental illness, because, you know, the dad's got it in the basement And they're like, oh shit, basement car. Better take it apart.
You know what? You know what's better than basement car? Wall car.
Wall car. Yeah, I don't even understand what that means. It's very, very strange to me. In 1929, Susie passed away, leaving the brothers alone in the brownstone. Though the brothers both had successful careers, they had up until this point never lived on their own. Once again, however, the brothers seemingly retained an aura of normalcy. Homer was still working as a lawyer, and Langley had moved on from performing as a concert pianist and had been enjoying a career as a piano dealer. The pair also continued to engage with the community outside of their home for another 4 years. The normalcy finally came to an end in 1933, when Homer's vision deteriorated rapidly due to hemorrhages in the back of his eyes. Langley resigned from his job to take care of his older brother full-time, and the pair began to retreat from society entirely while coasting on their saved income and inheritance. Yeah, so how you feeling about the ballad of the Collier Brothers so far, Dave?
Yeah, I'm into it, man. I think they're fucking weirdos. And, you know, is there a name for a child of the incest, for an incest child? Is there a name for that?
I don't know, but speaking of children of incest, Dave, do you have anything to plug?
Yes. I was actually more just curious if that was a term, because I was going to make a joke about them. But anyway, yeah, you could buy my book, Mary Tyler Moorhawk, wherever books are sold. Almost 300 pages, got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, heralded as a staggering work of genius by multiple trade publications. I'm basically going to be rich and famous from now on. So, you know what? Maybe you don't even buy it. Maybe you don't even buy it. I don't need your help. I don't need your fucking money. Actually, that's not true. None of this is true. Dear God, please help me sell some of these units so I don't disappoint Daddy Staros at Top Shelf. You can get Mary Tyler Moorhawk, wherever books are sold. It's a combination of Buckaroo Banzai and House of Leaves. Worked real hard on it. I wrote and drew it, and all the design is done by Mike Lopez, and there's photography in it, which is done by David Catalano. It's pretty cool. Spander, you got anything to fucking pimp?
Yeah, speaking of which, you've mentioned this a couple times on the show, and you failed to mention that the very same D. Catalano, who's the photographer that did all of the photography work for the book, is the supplier of the incidental music for Deep Cuts.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Old dirty David Catalano. Man of many talents.
If you want to pay your respects to the dear beloved Papa Pricey, you can get his book, Deadbolt AI Private Eye, by going to his website, dapricewrites.com, which is still somehow being kept up by some angel investor who pays the hosting fees and stores the books in a warehouse somewhere and fulfills them when you order them on the website. You can follow us on social media by going to Facebook and searching Deep Cuts Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by going to Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group, where we talk about the show, make memes, do other kind of fun stuff in there, have a nice little community going on. You can join our Discord server by going to bit.ly.com/deepcutsdiscord, where we also talk about the show, make memes, play games, and other cool stuff. You can follow us on Instagram at Deep Cuts Pod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow me on TikTok at Dead Boy Detective, where I make cool little videos about random trivia and facts and other stuff. Recently, I had a video that has gone viral where I talk about the fact that in the first draft of the Back to the Future script, originally, the reason why Doc Brown and Marty McFly are friends is because Doc Brown is poor because he spent all of his money on building the time machine. And so the way that he pays his rent is by bootlegging porn. And then he hired Marty McFly to sell it to other students. That video was received with a mixture of, oh my God, I can't believe that. And also, accusations that Doc Brown is a child groomer. So yeah, check that out on my TikTok page at Dead Boy Detective. Now back to the show. Act 2, The Hermits of Harlem. The exact reasons why the brothers began to fear the outside world are somewhat unclear. It is often stated that the brothers harbored discomfort over the changing racial demographics of their neighborhood. Though it is interesting to note that Harlem had already been a predominantly black neighborhood for the better part of a decade before the brothers withdrew into seclusion. In fact, the entire Harlem Renaissance had already come and gone by that time, making the brothers some of the only members of their community to have not given in to white flight in years prior. What do you make of that? Because my reaction to that is like, you know, it's 1885. The likelihood that these dudes are like super racist is not insignificant. However, on the flip side, given the information, It almost seems like a way of trying to like logically explain something that just can't be explained, which is that these dudes just secluded into their house for literally no reason other than they probably had some kind of generational mental illness. What do you make of that?
I mean, yeah, and that's kind of what my initial reaction was, something similar, where I was like, I don't know, especially because this sounds kind of glib, but one of them is literally blind, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, like, what does he care what people look like? Homie can't see, you know, which, of course, is glib and not true. And people with disabilities can be bigoted, too. I know. Yeah,
it's true that no blind people are racist.
I know. But to me, that doesn't read true. To me, that reads as the logic brain trying to sort out why the unknowable is happening. Like, it just...
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, like, it's nowhere near unheard of that two white guys in the 1800s were really racist. Number one, they were... Well, anyway, it's not unheard of. That's not a crazy idea, but... Oh, go ahead.
The other thing I would say, too, is that, like, they seem kind of like arrested development cases... in this period, right? It's going to get worse. But in this period, they're kind of just like floundering off of the breadcrumbs that their parents have left them. And so they might not have been like together enough to be able to take the house that they owned and sell it and move somewhere else. You know, like, they might have just been like, yeah, we don't like the shifting demographics, but like, we don't go outside anyway. So fuck it, whatever. We'll just stay here, with the implied agreement between the two of them being like, I don't fucking know how to sell a house.
Yeah.
How to sell a house? No, I'm blind. Okay, fuck it. Let's stay here then.
Yeah, totally could have been a little column A, little column B. But I do agree that it just seems like, in retrospect, trying to make sense of something that is just inherently nonsensical, which is the hoarding behaviors of two people who clearly had something going on mentally.
Yeah.
However, what did occur around the time they secluded themselves was the onset of the Great Depression, a crisis that particularly ravaged Harlem. The once affluent neighborhood around them now sat largely vacant, but the brothers once again remained seemingly unaffected. In 1932, a year before losing his vision, Homer bought the property across the street from their home with plans of renting it out as an apartment. Homer reportedly paid for the house in full with $7,500 in cash he casually produced from his pocket. Even after the two had stopped working, they seemed more than capable of living comfortably for the rest of their days. Despite having money for nurses and caretakers, Langley assumed the role of caretaker when Homer lost his vision, and the brothers began leaving the house less and less. Soon after, Homer lost use of his legs due to inflammatory rheumatisms in his joints and was never seen in public again. So, you know, a couple of interesting things, because, you know, you got to wonder what was going on financially in the family, because their father was a doctor, so clearly wealthy. But, you know, I don't necessarily know if, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't necessarily know if a doctor, even at this time, was making enough money to where if he died and left his savings over to his children, that they could just live in the lap of luxury for the rest of their lives and just casually be like, oh, how much does this building cost? $7,500, which is the equivalent of like $500,000 in this time. Let me see if I have it in my pocketbook. Like that seems like a lot of money for a doctor who died 2 years ago to leave over to his kids. So you got to wonder what actually is happening financially here. Why do they have
sperm,
like,
donors? They were both sperm donors.
Oh yeah, they donated sperm. But like back then, sperm donating was at a premium. Like you donated sperm once and you were set. That's actually what he's saying about in Allentown, Billy Joel. He was talking about the collapse of the sperm donating industry. Imagine if you could just like pull out money and buy the building across the street from you.
I fantasize about this every day.
Just the building across. You want the building across the street from you specifically?
How many times have I sent you photos of that building where there's an office building on top of it and there used to be a Chuck E. Cheese on the bottom?
As the vacant buildings around them decayed from neglect, so too did the Collier home. For whatever reason, the pair stopped paying their bills, cutting them off from water, gas, and electricity. In lieu of these services, they would burn oil lamps for heat, and Langley would fill jugs with water from a public water pump four blocks away. Langley also allegedly attempted to turn the Model T's engine into a generator and would wander at night in search of food and resources to haul back to their home. Langley was known to walk miles at night simply to buy bread from shops outside of their own neighborhood. Local shopkeepers, who probably had the most regular contact with Langley, stated that he was generally polite and rational, though he had a disheveled craziness to him. All right, so we've got some pictures here of Langley. So the one detail about this is that there seems to actually be no photos of Homer that exist. Photos were never taken of him. So we only have photos of Langley. And there are some photos that have been attributed to Homer, but they've basically been debunked and they're just photos of Langley. So we have this photo, sort of like a close-up photo of him here. We have a photo of him like hopping over a fence or something. Then we have a photo of him talking to some cops. So what are we seeing here, Dave?
My first thought is that, man, homeless, disheveled motherfuckers really did it different in the late 1800s and early 1900s, because this motherfucker's got a bow tie and is fairly clean shaven and is wearing a 3-piece goddamn suit.
Yep. Yeah, he's like a hobo Albert Einstein.
Yeah, I would say Langley looks like if they cast William H. Macy in an Albert Einstein biopic but couldn't afford a proper makeup and hair budget.
Oh, I was going to say they couldn't afford William H. Macy, so they got William I. Macy.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He also kind of, like, I still just don't get, like, okay, so the last photo of him talking to the cops, he looks fairly disheveled and, like, out to lunch. But the other two photos look fairly normal. And the other thing, too, is, like, how common is it to walk around with a fucking camera in, like, 1919? Like, this motherfucker's out here jumping a fence, and someone just happens to be there with a camera with a flash?
Yeah, yeah, we take it for granted with our 2024 brains, but the fact that somebody caught this dude like mid climbing a fence and took a picture of him that is like well developed, well exposed, and you can see him even though it's dark, is actually pretty crazy. And you got to wonder what was going on here and why they took this photo and how they knew he was going to be there. Because this had to be premeditated. This had to be somebody who was like going out and specifically trying to take a photo of him and like knew where he was going to be.
Also, he's climbing this fence made with of wrought iron with these massive spikes on the top. Is he just sitting on those spikes in that photo? Like, that looks like it's fun.
He's taking it full Albert Fish style. He's loving every second of it.
Man, that's brutal.
But also, like it's honestly just insane. It's crazy. So these two brothers, and even more so the fact that the Homer ends up becoming disabled. He's blind and essentially paralyzed. He can't walk. And especially for that fact, these two brothers, they are independently wealthy. They seem to have just plenty of money to do whatever they want. And this brother is disabled, so he needs like elevated care in order to be comfortable and survive and live a somewhat fulfilling life. And they have chosen to opt out of society and reject like the common amenities of life, electricity, gas, water, opt out of any kind of social contract, going to stores and buying goods, having things delivered to them, and have chosen intentionally the life of living holed up inside of a vacant building with no utilities, while one brother just ventures out into the streets and forages for food and water. Like, that I can't even imagine what the thought process is behind that.
Especially because Langley, like, had a career, right? Like, he was, like, an educated guy who, like, had a job and, like, could easily have just been like, all right, broski, I know it's going to be hard, but, like, stay in your room all day because I got to go make money so we can live.
Yeah, yeah. And Homer was a lawyer, but obviously, you know, there's obvious reasons why his career was shortened, although I'm assuming probably in a better mental state he still could have done some consulting work or something. I don't know, but yeah, Langley, he had like a piano repair business, and I don't even think they needed jobs. I think they just had money. And yet they've chosen to do this for no real rational reason. It wasn't like, oh, their parents died and they ran out of money and they decided, like, instead of getting jobs, we're just going to hole up in this building and live like mole people or something. They chose to do this.
Is this our future? Is this what's going to happen to us?
Absolutely. Yes. We're going to be holed up in a boarded up mystery treehouse, surviving off of just the various cans of space meat that Hilsmer has stored throughout the house. And in 40 years, it'll be like young kids like throwing rocks at our windows and talking about like old man Spandrew and Dave. And there's going to be all these legends about how we like cook children. And then we're going to befriend one of the children. And then they're going to learn that we actually aren't as bad as we're made out to be in the stories. And we're going to go on a magical adventure together.
It's like you got precognition.
Yeah, I'm openly just divining our futures right now. As the Great Depression dragged on, quality of life in Harlem continued to decline. Rumors began to spread about the rich old men who had rarely been seen in years. Kids threw rocks at their windows just to see what would happen, and desperate teens would break into the mansion in search of rumored valuables. This led Langley to wire the front door shut and boarded up all the windows on the first floor. Langley began only leaving the house in the absolute dead of night, ultimately leading him to construct elaborate booby traps within the home. And I just want to take this moment to just stop there and earmark this and just say, number one, these dudes holed up in their labyrinthian mansion and started building booby traps, which is fucking cool. First of all, it's fucking cool. But second of all, just stopping here to earmark that and say, just keep that in mind. They hole up in this mansion and then build a bunch of elaborate booby traps. And just keep that in mind as we listen to this, as we go through the story. And just remember that this goes exactly where it would go. Just keep that in mind. This is going exactly where it will go.
Just keep that in mind.
Another thing to think about is there's sort of this parallel. There's a parallel between this story and the story from that documentary Grey Gardens, which I'm sure a lot of people have seen. And, you know, it's very similar in that it's these two women who were sort of in the 1920s were very wealthy. And then through, you know, obvious years of mental degradation and onset of mental illness, they end up holing up in their Hollywood Hills mansion and removing themselves from society and sort of becoming these like hermit hoarder people. The key difference between the two stories, though, is that as opposed to the Grey Gardens story where these women are in this secluded mansion out of the way of the general population. So the story of their lives didn't really become known until years later, whenever they basically died. And then all of this footage was found of them filming themselves in their homes. And then it was, you know, assembled into this documentary. But the Collier brothers were going through their mental breakdown like in the middle of a hugely populated neighborhood in Harlem. So everything that was happening to them was just like happening out in the open. So unlike the Grey Gardens women who, like I said, we didn't really know about them until years later. They were already dead. And we found this footage and started discussing it. These guys became like weird, like local legends where people were just like, the Collier brothers, nobody's seen them in years. They say if you go into their house, the booby trap will fall off and knock and cut your head off. Like this was just happening. And it was like they became like these fixtures of the neighborhood in a really fascinating way.
The ghosts of Harlem past.
Yeah, the Jacob Marley. But make him brothers. In 1938, the New York Times ran a story on the brothers after their recent refusal to sell their home to a real estate agent for $125,000, or nearly $2.8 million in today's money. The Times also heavily leaned into rumors that the brothers were living lavishly within their home, sitting upon troves of valuable antiques and bundles of cash that they were too afraid to deposit into any bank. Intrigued by this story, Helen Worden, a reporter for the New York World Telegram, interviewed Langley and published some of the few direct quotes of his in existence. Famously, Langley decried,
"We've no telephone and we've stopped opening our mail. You can't imagine how free we feel."
So they were like hipsters of the whole like modern day thing where it's like, I'm not on social media. I don't even like take my phone with me when I leave the house. When asked about his disheveled appearance, he stated,
"I have to dress this way. They would rob me if I didn't."
Though Langley did not let Helen into the home, rumors of the brothers living lavishly within the home were stifled a year later when workers from Consolidated Edison attempted to force their way into the house to remove two gas meters that hadn't been used in a decade. Since Langley had barricaded the first floor, the workers struggled to find a way in, and every glimpse through the boarded windows or broken glass revealed a home packed full of furniture, trash, and newspapers. During the events, Langley had stormed outside in protest, causing a scene in which hundreds of local residents gathered to see the man many of them had only heard about in rumors. Langley later attempted to sue the gas company, claiming he had tried to have the gas turned on years ago but was unable to get service. During this very public scene, Langley also stated that he and his brother had been fine until the New York Times described them as wealthy hermits with money hidden around the house the year prior. 3 years later, in November of 1942, the Bowery Savings Bank attempted to evict the Colliers, who had not paid their mortgage for 3 years. Following a lack of response from the brothers, the bank sent a cleanup crew to the home, prompting Langley to once again make a public appearance. This time, Langley began yelling at the workers from a window on the upper level of the house. When the police arrived, they too attempted to force their way into the home. After knocking down the front door, they found Langley in a clearing he had made amongst the clutter. Without uttering a word, Langley wrote a check for $6,700, nearly $130,000 in today's money, settling the 3 years of mortgage due in a single payment. He then ordered everyone to vacate the premises immediately. The papers later read, "Bank and Colliers declare a truce." So once again, just to continue to highlight this, you know, they're not unable to pay for these things. They're not living in this desolation out of necessity because they don't have money. They're just like doing it. They're just like, I don't want to pay this mortgage. But then once somebody shows up and it's like, no, you have to, or else we're going to make you leave. They're like, oh, well, okay, here's $130,000 in today's money out of my pocket. Just take it.
Which is kind of fascinating and leads more to what we were saying of like, I really doubt that it was racially motivated and more just like this bizarre mental illness or bizarre thinking, you know, like.
Because it's like, they could have just resolved this problem a long time ago by just paying the mortgage. And they clearly had the money to do it. So it was just this weird obsession with secluding themselves and not having any contact with the outside world that caused them to arbitrarily just like not pay their mortgage. It's very strange. The bank had allowed Langley's payment to be valid despite the fact that they had technically already reclaimed ownership of the house. When discussing the bank's willingness to cooperate with the Colliers, their attorney stated that if difficulty should arise over the repurchase of the house, then the brothers could conveniently move as they owned the property right across the street. That house is a mansion, although it is also in poor condition, crushing any hopes neighbors might have to remove the strange pair from their block.
But also, like, what level of, like, who gives a shit? Like, are they out here really, like, breaking into other people's houses and causing problems, or are they just keeping to themselves being weirdos? Like, what do we care if they're being weirdos, you know?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to say, and I was going to say the opposite. I was going to say, I wouldn't want them to leave. I'd want these fucking weirdos living in my neighborhood, especially because, as you said, they're not really hurting anybody. They're not doing anything wrong. They're not causing a commotion. They're not coming out and like disturbing people, making noise that would be like annoying or anything like that. They're just like these weird dudes holed up in their mansion. I would find that fascinating, and I would not only not care, but I also would just be like, no, I want my weirdos here. I need them.
Make mine weirdos.
Yeah. In the following years, updates on the brothers' lives came in much the same way, through quick interviews with Langley during the few times he appeared in public. More often than not, to attend court hearings regarding various disputes with the city over the properties he and his brother owned. Langley always insisted that he and his brother were content, claiming he spent their days reading books to Homer and listening to music. Sometime around 1942, a police officer responding to a rumor that Homer had died managed to convince Langley to let him into the home. The office stated that Langley opened a basement door that had been wired shut and led him through maze-like corridors formed between piles of junk that reached the ceiling, warning him of the various booby traps he had constructed along the way. after what felt like half an hour, he finally lifted his flashlight to see a visibly annoyed man sitting like a mummy on a cot with his knees to his chest. This man simply stated,
"I am Homer L. Collier, the lawyer. I want your name and your shield number. I am not dead."
Seemingly confirming that he too was content within his home, which is kind of funny because, you know, that's like the thing that happens where, you know, some police officer is harassing you or they're just like unfairly questioning you about something. You see videos like this and people are like, "I want your name and your badge number." Whereas this dude is like, he's like, "Welcome into our fucking labyrinth of death. I'm going to lead you in here to prove to you that my mummified brother is alive." And then his brother's just in there, just totally blind. And he's just like, "Give me your name and your badge number. I'm going to report you to your supervisor."
Well, the other thing, too, that this story made me think of, like, throughout its entire duration is, do you think that they had a relationship with each other?
Oh, they were fucking.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know. I mean, dad's hanging out with his cousin. Like, they're so attached and, like, divorced of context. This person is stealing and living a hermetic lifestyle with someone, romantically reading books to them and taking care of their every need when he could have the money to put them in an assisted living facility or hire a nurse to help out. But instead he's like, "No, I will take care of my brother.
We will build a booby-trapped love dungeon."
Yeah, like, I don't know. Did you have any of those thoughts?
Here's the thing. I'm going to say I did not at all. This thought never crossed my mind until this moment. That being said, though, like, hearing that from you, I'm not like, "Oh, I didn't think about that. That's weird." I kind of am like thinking you're right. I didn't think of that. It didn't pop into my mind. But now that you're saying it, I'm like, they had to be doing something in there. Even if it was like just jerking off in the same room, like there's no way that you just live together with another person secluded inside of a house for like 40 years and you're not doing something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man.
They're at least jerking off in the same room together and getting some kind of, it's getting them there in a way that is more than just the jerking off. In another interview around this same time, Langley was quoted as saying,
"Homer and I decided we would not call any doctors. You see, we know too much about medicine. Doctors would remove Homer's optic nerve, and he would be blind forever. And they would treat his rheumatism with drugs, and that would shorten Homer's life."
Further stating,
"We decided to do it our way, by diet and rest. Homer eats 100 oranges a week and is improving. He can sit up a little now. We believe in letting nature take its course. I cook his meals and have to cut up his meat into little cubes so he can eat it with a spoon. I have to bathe him and tend to his wants." See? I have to bathe him and tend to his wants?
Yep.
Come on.
That's a bathtub handy right there.
"I used to read to him. We have all the classics in our library. I used to read Shakespeare and Dickens, but my eyes went bad and I stopped, so now we just talk and listen to the radio."
Throughout the course of this interview, Langley seemed convinced his brother would make a near full recovery, even after all these years.
"When Homer first lost his sight, he used to see visions of beautiful buildings, always in red. He would describe them to me, and I would try and paint them just as he directed. Someday, when Homer regains his sight, I will show him the paintings."
Yeah, so these dudes are like, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. Number one, they're like this very specific cocktail of like homeopathic, anti-science, Christian scientists, libertarians who are just like, you know, these you know, big farmers pumping us full of these drugs and we don't need them. And most of the things, you know, depression doesn't exist. You just need to drink water and run. And like all these things that are wrong with us, you could just fix them by taking like essential oils and stuff. And just like fucking loading yourself with vitamin C every day by eating 100 oranges. And then there's also like this other thing of like their dad was a doctor. And then they seem to have internalized that and taken away like this extreme distrust for medicine and thinking that it's all some kind of weird scam or something like that. So then you got to wonder, like, what's going on there? Like, what was the relationship like with the father where, you know, not only were they kind of estranged from him when their parents were divorced, but also like they seem to have like internalized this hatred for his entire profession. Perhaps the last major public appearance of Langley was documented by a New York Times article published January 28, 1947. The article chronicles the city's purchase of a strip of the farmland in Queens that their father Herman had owned. During these dealings, the pastor of a church neighboring the farmland, who had tried to buy a portion of the land from the brothers before, invited Langley out for a tour of the area. On the tour, the pair visited the Idlewild Airport Project and LaGuardia Field, to which Langley admitted that, despite holding an engineering degree, he had never seen an airplane up close. Despite the pastor's attempts to charm Langley, he reportedly simply stated that he and Homer had spent many carefree childhood days on the land, and that,
"Had I known that Queens was so greatly improved since our time here, I should have fixed a much higher price for our property."
So once again, like, it's not even, like, the thing you were talking about before was, like, they just kind of didn't know how to sell a house, and so they just kind of acquiesced into the situation because they just were in a state of arrested development and just didn't know how to do it. Even that, to a certain degree, like, they owned farmland that they could have, like, at least gone out there and spent some time in the fresh air, not been holed up in a weird dungeon for 40 years, and they never went out there, and then they just sold that. So, really, it's just, like, it's really hard to get a lock on, like, what the thought process or mental state of any of this is.
I know we've been making a lot of jokes about this, but I actually genuinely mean this. Is cognitive impairment it is a side effect of inbreeding, right?
I mean, yeah, 100%. Whether that is the case here, obviously we don't know that, but yeah, I mean, physical and mental deformations and whatever are, yes, a result of inbreeding. Yeah, I mean, that could be a very good explanation for it.
That seems more likely to me than, like, they weren't racist.
Yes. Or you mean they were racist?
No, because they stayed in Harlem, so they weren't racist.
Oh, you're saying that they were probably crazy and racist?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. Act 3. The brothers leave home. On March 21st, 1947, police and firemen carried Homer Collier's body through a second-story window and down a ladder towards a crowd of onlookers below. They had been responding to an anonymous caller claiming they were certain one of the Colliers had died. Police arrived on the scene and, to their surprise, faced no resistance as they prodded their way into the house. Police eventually broke through the front door with an axe, releasing a foul stench of mildew which swept across the crowd that had already formed. Past the front door, the police were met with a barricade of junk, with no other way to proceed. They began pulling objects out of the barricade and piling them onto the street. Furniture, frying pans, bicycles, and stacks of newspapers began to crowd the sidewalk. Amidst this scene, patrolman Willie Parker climbed up a fireman's ladder and into a second-story window, calling out that he had found a body within minutes of entering the building. Homer was estimated to have been dead for 10 hours. He sat with his head resting against his knees, which were pulled up to his chest, the same position the officer had found him in 5 years prior. The coroners reported that he had died of starvation. It was initially thought that Langley had left the anonymous tip, not knowing what to do with the brother's body, and then fled the scene before police arrived. After spending the entire day searching the house for Langley, police began to stuff all the objects they removed back into the house as neighbors had been attempting to rummage through the boxes in search of cash and valuables. The police had the home boarded up once again by nightfall. So we've got some photographs here. We got a picture of them, like, climbing into the window with a ladder, and we got a picture of William Parker climbing in through the window. So what do you think of these, Dave?
First of all, damn, those ladders are fucking long.
Yep.
Second, this photography is really nice. Like, if you told me that these were stills from, like, a Buster Keaton movie, I would totally believe that.
Particularly the photo of William Parker climbing into the window, it looks like a screenshot from a movie.
Yeah.
Like, when I was reading through the script and I glanced at that photo, I thought that it was, like, leading up to, like, a movie was made about this or something like that. And then I read it and I was like, oh, no, this is literal photography of this event. So, yeah, beautiful photography of them pulling this dead body out of this hoarder house. A funeral was held for Homer on April 1st. 50 people attended, yet Langley was still nowhere to be seen. In the first week since news broke that Homer was dead and Langley was missing, the police station had been flooded with alleged sightings of Langley on the run. Investigators followed some of the leads to different states, but turned up nothing of substance. All the while, a team had been slowly making progress clearing the house out. They had even cut a hole in the roof in an attempt to bypass some of the maze-like tunnels Langley had constructed. They continued to pull out odd objects and discover more tunnels that Langley had sealed off behind him each time he passed through. They consistently ran into tin cans hung on wires designed to alert the brothers of intruders, and heavy objects hung high to crush those who dislodged the wrong objects. When questioned about Langley's whereabouts, John R. McCullen, their lawyer of 15 years, stated,
"Your guess is as good as mine, but I think he is in the house, myself."
Despite implying he thought Langley was alive, McCullen was proven right days later on April 8th, when Langley's body was found a mere 10 feet away from where Homer had been found. Langley was pinned to the floor within one of his own tunnels, having accidentally triggered a booby trap while bringing Homer food. He presumably suffocated under the weight of the boxes, which collapsed over his head. Langley was estimated to have died around March 9th, meaning Homer sat helpless for roughly 12 days before succumbing to his hunger. So
The thing I'm not quite clear on is, I understand he was seeing impaired, and I understand that the house was a little treacherous, but, like, did he sit there because he knew about the booby traps but wasn't sure which booby trap was where, and because he couldn't see, he didn't think he could navigate it, so he, like, willfully starved to death there? Or was his body atrophied because of his illnesses, and so he didn't have a choice, and he kind of died of hunger trapped in his body?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that his body had atrophied pretty significantly, but also he had, like, rheumatoid arthritis in his leg, so he couldn't walk. Mm. That's why he was stuck in that position, is because he couldn't actually walk.
Gotcha.
So even if he wasn't, he probably just couldn't get up at all. But I mean, hoisted by his own petard, like, to the most extreme degree. As I said before, the fact that he was, like, haphazardly booby trapping their labyrinthian tunnel mansion was going in the direction you thought it was going to go, and he ends up getting killed by one of his own booby traps.
Fucking rough, man.
Yeah. Which is that old cliche that you hear about in, like, urban legends or whatever, where there's a story about a man who was, like, really paranoid of intruders. So he, like, installed this, like, really elaborate security system in his house and barred all of his windows and made it really impossible to break in. And then there was a house fire, and then he ends up burning to death because he can't get out of his house because of all the elaborate security things he built. It's like that old cliche of, like, the paranoia of the fear of the other will eventually destroy you from within. But in this case, it's true. It really happened. Langley was buried next to Homer and their parents in unmarked graves at Cypress Hills Cemetery in Brooklyn. In the coming weeks, many relatives made appearances at the house in an attempt to stop police from throwing away or confiscating any valuables. Out of the 56 claimed relatives, 23 were deemed legitimate, all of whom were cousins. And you could tell because they were just all making out. These cousins split the estate equally, though much of the home's contents were deemed worthless and auctioned off to people passing by on the sidewalk during the cleanup process. The home, having been neglected for decades, was deemed an unsafe fire hazard in July of 1947 and was razed shortly after. The brothers' story became the first documented case of hoarding as we know it today. For decades after, East Coast firefighters referred to hoarder houses as Collier Mansions, and generations of mid-century kids grew up being told that if they didn't clean their rooms, they would end up like the Collier brothers. The vacant plot upon which their brownstone once stood has been known as the Collier Brothers Park since the 1960s. So we have a couple of photos here to wrap things
up. The Collier Brothers Park, this shit is like a 20 by 20
square. Go ahead and describe it. This is the first picture, modern-day photo of the site where their house stood.
It's, like, literally a 20 by 20 square with, like, three trees growing out of the center of it. A park is a little of an overstatement.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a little dog run. You can take your dog in here and they can shit all over the Collier Brothers legacy. It is kind of interesting that they decided not to ever build anything on top of that land, considering, you know, the obvious greed of real estate developers, and also the cramped real estate of New York City. They just were like, we're never going to put another place here. It's just going to be a little dog park. But then there's some other photos here of basically police pulling out just all of the bric-a-brac from the Collier Mansion post their death. It's just a fucking hoarder house, just piles of boxes.
This police officer holding up a steering wheel, a bunch of, like, guys that look like they talk like this, see? Hauling out, like, radios that don't appear to work, and a grand piano, and then, like, a hard-nosed Mike Miller-style police detective mugging underneath a collapsing wall of boxes and like pointing at
it. Yeah, it's like one of the booby traps. Yeah, this booby trap is like a big pile of boxes, and then it's kind of like leaning up against like an atrium overhead, and the boxes are kind of positioned in a way where like if you were to like pull something the wrong way, all these boxes would just collapse over onto you, which is, you know, that's what happened to our boy Langley. Really kind of crazy story. Once again, another one of those deep cuts OGs where it's like, man, I can't believe I never heard about this because it's like pretty wild. So do you have any closing thoughts about the Collier brothers, Davy boy?
I think my closing thoughts on the Collier brothers are, first, don't have children with your cousins. Second, don't get into a relationship with your brother. Third, going outside is good. Fourth, don't make homemade booby traps. I know it's tempting, but just don't.
Fun fact, it's illegal to booby trap your house.
You know this from personal experience?
I know it from personal research experience, writing podcast episodes. But it's illegal to booby trap your house because if you die and the police or paramedics need to come into your house, they could get hurt on one of your booby traps. So it's completely illegal to do it.
Interesting. And I think my overall final thought is these stories like this are very compelling to me because of the conundrum of why. And not even that I'm necessarily interested that much in a why, but I'm more interested in stories where there is an unknowable. There isn't a knowable why, which is what's fascinating. You want to ascribe a sense of logic and or a sense of humanity sometimes to these stories. And the truth of the matter is sometimes people aren't in control of their own impulses and do things that don't match up with a logical worldview. So it's always fascinating to kind of try and unpack that and see where the behavioral patterns and rhythms and kind of circular, you know, beginnings and ends of those behaviors are. I'm going to clean my apartment now because seeing all those photos of that hoarding gave me a lot of anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very fascinated in the question of why people do the things that they do up to a certain point, I think. And I think for some people in this philosophical quest for discovering the why of human behavior, they can lose the plot and get hung up on specifically the why to the point where you start to lose sight of the real thing that you're trying to understand, which is like human behavior, because there isn't always a why, a logical A to B to C reason for why people do things. And there can be sometimes where you kind of make these logical connections and you notice these patterns and you say like, oh, well, the reason why this person did this is because when they were a child, this happened to them. But then if you get really hung up on that having to be the case, that there has to be some kind of logical provenance of something that somebody's done, you end up losing sight of the fact that sometimes people just do shit for no fucking reason. And that's where you get into these situations where people are trying to rationalize things. When in reality, it was more likely the case that these dudes were just like deeply mentally ill. And as you were kind of saying, like that in of itself is something that's fascinating to study and look at of like this, not like why did these guys do this, but this is what happens whenever unchecked mental illness is allowed to validate itself in a loop and just exist in a vacuum. And that's very interesting and worth studying like in and of itself. And trying to rationalize it away and be like, oh, well, they did this because of this or whatever. It kind of misses the point of what the actual study is, what the actual interesting thing about this is.
I don't know. It really kind of puts you into a contemplative perspective because I, too, have a deep love of weirdos and urban legends and, oh, you won't believe Mr. So-and-so down the street. You know, he killed a guy in the 70s and got away with it and hasn't left his house since.
Yeah, those are the legends about you and your apartment building.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah, the gringo up the way, he fucking killed somebody back in the fucking 90s and he hasn't left that tiny apartment since. You know, I love urban legends and folklore and kind of the way these stories take on a life of their own in these kind of small hermetically sealed, you know, units of measurement like a city block or a small town. But when you come face to face with the toll that that is taking on a human level, right? Like the root pain that spawns that interesting story, it gives you a little bit more pause when you're like, wow, these two guys, like, they really suffered, you know, and seemingly needlessly.
Yeah, for whatever weird internal reasonings that they had, they kind of just lived an abject life of misery for like 20, 30 years because something in their mind just compelled them to remove themselves from society, even though they just did not need to.
Yeah, really, really sad.
Yep.
Well, on that note, I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Spandrew Spice.
This has been Deep Cuts. If you'd like to find me on the internet, you can do so at heydavebaker.com. You can find my books, Halloween Boy, Mary Tyler Moorhawk, Everyone's Tulip, and a whole bunch of other stuff on there. Please go buy Mary Tyler Moorhawk wherever you get your books. Spandrew, where can people find you online?
Well, once again, you can follow us on Facebook by searching Deep Cuts Podcast. You can join our Facebook group, the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group, where we talk about the show and make memes and other cool stuff. You can follow us. You can join our Discord server, bit.ly.com/Deep Cuts Discord, where we talk about the show, make memes and play games and all kinds of other stuff. You can follow us on Instagram at Deep Cuts Pod. You can follow us on TikTok at Mystery Treehouse. You can follow me on TikTok at Dead Boy Detective. And you can come to the Mystery Treehouse and throw rocks at our window as we slowly descend into madness, refusing to come out and, you know, whatever else is going on in there. Deep Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.
This episode of Deep Cuts was written by Armand Saheli. If you're interested in writing an episode of Deep Cuts, please email andrew@boygeniusmedia.com. The incidental music for this episode was created by D. Catalano, whose music can be found at wekeepoddhours.bandcamp.com.